Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm George Capiello on behalf of the appellants, Scott Kelly and John DeWald. The issue before this Court is whether or not Star Indemnity had a duty to defend Mr. Kelly and Mr. DeWald. The provision of a defense is perhaps maybe the most significant type of insurance coverage that directors and officers would seek in order to ensure that they have the superior resources provided by an insurance carrier to defend claims that might pull in officers and directors for activities that they probably shouldn't have been pulled in to begin with, sham or frivolous complaints. In this case, the duty to defend analysis that's required and that the district court failed to really even explore requires looking at the policy and looking at the underlying complaint and determining whether there's potentiality of coverage. It's not about whether there's ultimately going to be coverage or ultimate indemnity. It's just a matter of determining if there any potential way, even by amendment, the complaint would potentially fall into some type of coverage. And in that sense, in that case, the insurance company would be required to defend, and that duty to defend would be ongoing until it's conclusively determined there is no duty to defend.
Let me ask you this, counsel. Don't the reinsurer and other cases indicate that a misrepresentation can still act as a defense to an insurer's duty to defend, even if formal rescission is unavailable?
I don't agree that that's what reinsurer calls for. I believe the rescission cases that are cited by Star in this matter, I don't believe are fully applicable here, because all those cases, what they have in common are that an actual declaratory relief action was either brought or in a cross complaint brought by the insurance company, and that there were issues of facts ultimately determined by that. And so if what Your Honor is asking is whether or not an affirmative defense is available, then I believe that it would be. But what we have here is issues of fact. We don't know, and certainly the district court judge was not certain as to what Mr. DeWald understood the application questions to mean, what Mr. Brennan was requesting when he was asking to be paid on promissory notes. And because there are issues of fact, this needs to be sent to a jury to determine. And it cannot be just adjudicated on summary judgment. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
Well, in part. What I'm concerned about is, although the policy itself clearly limits the kind of relief that they could have, the reality is if it were rescinded ab initio, you have a slightly different situation. And that's why I'm asking, because in this case, you know, they're, the underwriter, I'll call him the underwriter, indicated that she wouldn't have issued the policy on the terms had she known of the 2010 Brennan demand. Do you have any evidence to suggest that that is false? Is there anything to counter that? Because that's what's in the record, and that suggests that, hey, you know, if this had been known, there's no way this would have ever occurred. Was it countered?
Right. No. Let me rephrase that. Thompson v. Occidental, the California Supreme Court, stated that a trier of fact's not required to believe any post-mortem, you know, self-serving statement that something wouldn't have been written or not in affidavits for summary judgment.
I get that, unless it's not countered. And in this case, well, if I understand correctly, what was said by the underwriter that she would simply not have written this policy had this disclosure been made, I don't see you saying, well, that's not true. There's this and that, and then that's a matter of material fact. So if what she said is true, there never would have been a policy in the first place. And then you don't get to the issue you're talking about. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, but I don't agree that they just don't get a policy of an issue without some type of declaratory relief or some type of case being brought by the insurer. And the other thing to keep in mind here is that there's definitely a dispute as to what Starr believes was being asked and answered and to what Mr. DeWald believed. I took some exception to Starr's respondent's brief in that they continue to say that what was asked was if there was any claim made. And that's not what these applications were asking. It was asking whether or not there was information of misstatements, negligence, errors, acts, or omissions that would lead, and the person answering would think would reasonably believe to lead to a covered claim. That means that there would have to be some accusation of a wrongful act. So it's almost like ships passing in the night. You have an underwriter who's claiming, we were asking for any type of demand for a monetary payment on a promissory note, and you didn't give me that answer. And on the other side, you have, well, there was a request to pay a promissory note, which is a contract claim and never covered under a director's and officer's policy. So why would that ever lead to any covered claim for a wrongful act? And certainly the other important thing to understand is that these individuals never backed any of these contracts. There was no reason for them to individually believe they had any potential liability. They got pulled in by the underlying claimant in an overbroad, frivolous action.
Let me ask you this. I get your point, but let's just say we look at the form that was filled out, the checklist, and based on that language, we think, I don't see anybody could have mistaken this, and there's no response to it. What do we do then?
When you say no response, you mean
in the
record?
Their underwriter put in a declaration indicating that she never would have underwritten this, never would have been a policy. You didn't say anything to the contrary. So if I get your point that if these are ships passing in the night, then you're absolutely right. Then you need to have a duty to defend, find out what it really means, and so on and so on. But if we look at this and we say, oh, this is really clear. This is, nobody could mistake this. What do we do with that?
That's a great question. And I feel like the California law under Gray and Montrose Chemical and their progeny is meant to create a prophylactic effect so that insurers don't just on a whim or in reading into facts make self-serving statements or conclusions and deny a defense. It's really important when these individuals needed it most and then come back later when they do get sued for breach of contract and bad faith, and then do their investigation, and then make their arguments as to why they may or may not have had a duty to defend. If the district court's decision is upheld, I feel as though it's neutering the important prophylactic effect that the state of California wanted to make sure to protect consumers, and it's there to protect insurers as well. Because there are remedies available. Before we even got to here, Starr could have brought its own declaratory relief action. It could have sought remedies. It could have sought remedies in court and had allocations provided for what was covered claims and not. And it refused to do that and left our clients hanging.
Did you ask them to do it, or are you just saying that was not their policy? They strategically decided not to do it.
There was multiple requests by Mr. Kelly and DeWald to please come and defend us all the way up until the ultimate case was settled.
Oh, I see. Because you're saying you made the demand for for them to cover your.
Okay. They in fact did agree to provide a defense, and nothing has changed. Nothing had changed when they ultimately decided not to continue the defense. So the four corners of the complaint had a potential for coverage. I don't think that's in dispute here. And because of that, there was a duty to defend, and the court should reverse and remand. And I'll reserve whatever minutes I have.
35 seconds, wow.
Thank you.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Davison for Star Indemnity and Liability Company. There's at least four reasons this case is not covered. The easiest path has already been identified by Your Honor.
So we stop there, and let me ask you, how would Kelly respond to a conclusory statement made by an underwriter that says we wouldn't have written the policy? How do they contest that issue?
Well, they could have cross-examined the underwriter on that issue when they took that underwriter's deposition, which they chose not to do for whatever reason. They could have hired an expert, underwriting expert, to come in and say that's not true. But, of course, they didn't, because no underwriter would have written this risk. If they knew there was a $423,000 demand by an investor, that would have been carved out. The policy would not have been issued. There's many things that could have been done, but we did not get that opportunity to do that. So to your point, Your Honor, the record is the record, but if I were speculating, which is kind of what you're asking me to do, I would say it's not unfair because it's crystal. It's crystal that nobody's going to write this risk in the way they wrote it without complete information, and that is material to the underwriter, and it was material to the insured. They act like this was not a big deal to them, this huge demand and the threat of a lawsuit. It was very material to them. This is a two-person development company. So the point, to Your Honor's point, we can raise this as a defense. We did raise it as a defense. There's two cases, DeCampo and Barrera, that allow us to raise it as a defense. We do not have to bring an affirmative claim. We can raise it as affirmative defense. That's been settled in California for a long time. And the question in the application asks for any circumstance that might lead to a claim. When you have a demand like the 2010 Brennan demand, it's incomprehensible to anybody that that's not going to come.
That was a contractual claim, was it not?
I understand that argument, Your Honor, but again, the question asks not for is the claim covered. The question asks for any potential claim that might lead to a claim. And under that circumstance, when you have a demand of that size in a small company, it should have been disclosed because as we...
It depends upon the size?
But 423 is big enough for anybody to disclose. That certainly... The underwriter determines materiality, not the insured. That was not attacked for whatever reason, but the case law is clear that it's the subjective view of the underwriter as the reasonably subjective view of the underwriter. It can be attacked, but it was not attacked. It is absolutely undisputed in this case that Pat Barrett, who was the underwriter for this, would not have written this policy had it been otherwise. The fact that it was a quote-unquote breach of contract, we all know, as any kind of investment scenario, the underwriter is looking to assess the risk reward, and in any kind of investment scenario, this kind of claim frequently involves the 27 different claims that ultimately they made that all arise out of the same four promissory notes. But even if that's not true, Your Honor, there's three other ways to deny this claim and defeat coverage. The first is the Brennan claim was a claim made before this policy incepted. This is a claim made and reported policy. This is not an occurrence policy.
Only if the August demand was a claim.
Only if the August demand was a claim. That's correct, Your Honor. In my view, under the case law in California, and particularly under the Abdefell case, a claim is any demand. This is a claim. It is also defined in the policy as a written demand for money or damages. That's what this is.
But if that were so, then businesses across the country that get D&O insurance to cover their officers and directors who engage in commerce all the time and transactions, you're saying that if there's any breach of contract, default on a note, that the insured should anticipate that there will be additional claims for that failure to pay.
I think that's realistic, number one. Number two, I think that it's up to them to disclose it so we know what we're writing. and it's not unfair to ask them to disclose it, which is why it's in the application. And right below the application is language that makes it clear if you don't disclose the information you have, it's not covered whether disclosed or not. It's not like it's hidden. It's in bold type in the application that this is required. It's not unfair. It's unfair to the underwriter because the underwriter is not getting a chance to evaluate the risk. Now, there's also two exclusions in the policy, one of which is in the application, that says all that's required is a false statement and knowledge of that concealment. They knew about the Brennan demand. That's not disputed. They've never disputed that. What's been disputed is their characterization of what it meant.
I think what I'm troubled about is that you would ultimately win probably pretty clear under the exclusions, if not before. They're saying, though, you still have a duty to defend. As long as there's any dispute, any colorable way to get from point A to point B. I get the point about the rescission. We talked about that before. You say the second point is that this claim wasn't made timely because it was a claims-made policy, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So if that's correct, then on its face, there's no coverage, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And that would include the duty to defend?
Correct, Your Honor.
Was occurrence coverage available, but they just didn't buy it?
No, all the D&O policies are claims made and reported policies.
They all are.
They all are.
So
they had a previous policy with another company, Ace, and that was a claims made and reported. I've been in this business for a long time, and that's the nature of these insurance.
No, I know. I know that they seem to be. When I practiced law here, but for years occurrence was the norm. But I think 20 years ago they changed it or something. But is that true in D&O?
The D&O policy, this is just showing my age, Your Honor, but the first D&O policy I handled was in 1985. The first D&O, if you want the history, the first D&O policy was issued out of London, and my firm represented that underwriter in a case involving Bank of
America. I'm going back farther than that, so
okay,
it's really a long time ago.
Well, I'm glad somebody's. Anyway, so.
I graduated from eighth grade in 1985.
I know. These kids.
The point I'm trying to make has been around for a long time, and that's the form. And claims made and reported in the Homestead case in California has been upheld as a perfectly acceptable way to limit your risk. It's a short-tail policy as opposed to a long-tail policy, meaning the exposure is supposed to end in a relative finite period of time. And that's why it says claims made. You make the claim. And we thought it was a claim-made policy. We thought it was a claim made during the policy period when we first got the case, which is why we defended initially. And then we got information that it had been made before the policy, and they hired outside counsel, and it was communicated directly and clearly. So
is your prior claim a made argument based solely on this August 2010 email, or is there evidence in the record of something else? And it does seem to me that there was some accommodation made subsequent to August between the parties concerning that demand and rewriting of the obligation.
Yeah, I want to make sure I understand, Your Honor, what you're asking.
I compounded the question.
Because I think the August 12, 2010 written demand for $423,000 based on four promissory notes, two of which were past due, and a threat to sue if they didn't get the money, I think that is a claim made. And then thereafter, on November 17, 2011, a year later, there was a written demand made by Brennan's counsel on the insured.
Which was after the policy was written.
And if that was it, then we would have defended this claim, Your Honor. But unfortunately for the insured, this other demand existed, which, fair is fair, right? So when you talk about fair, so we get the case, we defend, they send April 17, 2012, 2 years after the fact, Brennan sends a draft complaint. They pass the draft complaint on to us, and at that time we see this problem about a prior claim made that should have been tendered to their other carrier, which they had insurance. I don't know why they didn't tender it to their other carrier, but they didn't.
That was your first notice of the earlier demand was the face of the complaint that was sent, right?
The first notice was a copy of a demand letter from Brennan's counsel. Second notice was the draft complaint that they were separated in time.
What's your best case indicating that the factual underpinning of this case, that is the earlier demands and then the demand by counsel, is sufficient to constitute a claim under a claims-made policy?
I think probably the best case is the Abdefell case, Your Honor, which I have cited in the brief, and I can give you the cite if you would like it.
How do you spell that?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it properly, to be honest. Let me, if you don't mind me flipping through my papers here.
Abifadel versus
Correct,
Cigna.
Your Honor. That's correct.
And what? Okay, Abdefell? Okay.
Yeah, here. Hang on one second.
It's 8 Cal App 4th, 145.
That's correct. Thank you, Your Honor. At 160. That's where the court talks about the definition of claim.
Okay. Any other questions by my colleague? Thank you very much for
your
presentation. All right, counsel, I have a brief time for rebuttal.
Real quick, Your Honor. Again, counsel is conflating claims made without including the most important aspect, which it has to be a wrongful act. It has to have alleged wrongful acts for it to be a claim.
Well, let's go directly to the rescission issue and whether or not the record is sufficient to just conclude that it is void ab initio.
I'm not sure if I understand your question. I'm sorry about that.
Well, the insurance company is saying that that the misrepresentation, material misrepresentation, constitutes a basis for rescission of the contract.
And I would say that's an issue of fact, and that this should have been sent on to a jury.
And their answer was you could have deposed the underwriter.
Well, they were deposed, and again, it's self-serving statements in an affidavit that were put in and not deposition testimony. And last, real quick, I'm sorry I'm out of time, but the Abifadel v. Cigna case at pinpoint 167 actually found that claims made against a bank and not the director specifically is not a claim, as well as not holding or accusing the actual directors of any wrongful acts is not a claim.
Your time's up, but I would like you to answer one more question.
Sure.
Do you believe that any underwriter who knew the facts of this case would have written this policy?
Yes.
You do?
I do.
Have you ever seen that done in a similar situation?
Well, these situations don't normally come up because usually the insurance company provides a defense, and then they deal with it in the way that they're supposed to and go for declaratory relief actions.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
The case just argued is submitted. We thank counsel for their argument.